Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is Earl Swift. He is the author of the new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. He's here to talk about that island, the challenges they face, potential solutions, etc. Earl, thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Chris, Nell, thanks so much for having me.
Great. I thought we would break the conversation down into roughly thirds. The first third, we'll get some history and some background on Tangier Island, and then we'll move forward and talk about some of these environmental and perhaps cultural and economic challenges the island is facing, and then perhaps delve into some of the potential solutions. So first, Earl, if you could, give us a little, our listeners out here in Park City, Utah, a little background on what and who Tangier Island is.
Okay, this is a squiggle of marsh and mud, 12 miles from the nearest mainland port. It's been settled since 1778 and is now populated by about 460 people, all but a few of whom can trace their lineage to the first settlers who arrived in the 18th century. It's essentially treeless. It's about a mile by three. Most of that, 70% or better, is salt marsh, which floods twice a day with each high tide.
Hmm.
And it is as close to being an amphibious place to live as you can probably find in the lower 48. Most of it fails to clear 3 feet above the tides. Mm. Actually, most of it fails to clear one. It's been salt marsh.
Wow.
But even the parts of the island in which you could put up a house are just barely above the water. It's wafer thin. So it's a place that does not have a lot of elevation to give up. And since 1850, it's given up quite a bit. It's not only is the bay around it rising, as are these around the world, but the island itself, along with the entire southern Chesapeake, is subsiding. The Earth's crust there is sinking into the mantle. And that 1-2 punch of land going down and water coming up has spelled big trouble for Tangier and predictions that it will have to be abandoned within 25 years.
Wow. And give us a picture of the the economic scene on the island. How do people make a living?
Well, it's all tied to the water, as you would expect. Historically, it's Tangiermen have relied on the bay and its bounty of crabs in the summer and oysters in the winter for their sustenance, and continue to do so. That is the number one source of income for the island to this day. An increasing number of islanders have decided to forego the uncertainties of crabbing and oystering and have joined the crews of tugboats that are parts of companies that are well off the, well away from the island. They're at opposite ends of the bay in Philadelphia and down in Hampton Roads. And so those folks are gone for weeks at a time. Otherwise, there's a nascent tourist industry, but the income from tourism winds up in relatively few hands, and so you really can't call that a viable way for the island to earn its keep.
So the Chesapeake, in general, seems to have suffered a number of insults, let's call them, over the decades. High nutrient loadings leading to algal blooms and then the knock-on effects to, in this case, crabbing and oyster industries. Has the island kind of weathered, the Tangier watermen weathered those challenges, or do they face similar challenges now?
I think that if you were to ask most of the bay's regular users, you'd be told that it's looking better in the past couple of years than it has. For many years prior, it's turbidity is way down. The water's clear. Underwater grasses seem to be healthy. The crab population has been very robust for the last couple of years. Oysters have bounced back from the brink of extinction just a few years ago.
Right. We can talk a little bit about that. Some of the diseases that the oysters confronted. Was it Dermo and I think it was MSX. Yeah.
To microscopic parasites that really did a number on the population. And you know, the oyster population in the Chesapeake was almost inconceivably vast back at the time of the Civil War, say, and became the target of just a pillaging during the late 19th century. The bay was plundered of its oyster population, and so overfishing had been a problem for 75 years by the time these microscopic nasties showed up to seemingly finish the job that oystermen had started. And it was, you know, it looked in the early 80s like the American oyster in the Chesapeake Bay was doomed to completely disappear. It came close.
Hmm.
It came very close. And it's only in the last few years that scientists have detected a resilience, the species has evolved, it appears, not uniformly and not everywhere in the bay, but there are places in the bay where the species appears to be evolving defenses against these predators that are, that they're passing down to their young. And the oyster has made such a comeback that Virginia has reopened its wintertime wild oyster dredging fishery, which if you had asked people 30 years ago what the prospects of that were, I think they would have told you were dreaming.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more, too, about a little more background about the people on this island. You say they've been populated this Tangier Island since the 1700s, correct?
1778.
Where was their origin? Or what was it?
Well, they were from elsewhere around the bay, most directly. I guess most of the islanders can probably trace their lineage to Cornwall. That seems to be where a good many of them, their family trees, hail from.
Mm-hmm.
The first guy who settled the island was a man named Joseph Crockett. Showed up, built a house on one of the three parallel ridges of sandy loam that rise almost imperceptibly from the marsh on Tangier. And his grandchildren are really the wellsprings for the rest of for the population today. His granddaughters in particular are, moved onto the island with their husbands and different parts of the island. And you can still see their names. Their surnames reflected that the men they married were Parkses and Pruitts, and those are the two big names now. Joseph Crockett himself, his name is the third most abundant on the island. So it's a place, it's one big extended family.
Yeah.
And that has never changed. It's always been that way. Now, what has changed is that in the last, since the 30s, really, the last 80 years, the population has steadily declined, it has reached kind of a crisis today. Insofar as it's now a pretty old population. The median age is in the mid to late 50s, and you've got a lot of islanders in their 80s and 90s. No young people staying. Very few islanders of childbearing years remaining on board, and. And so a demographic collapse is looming along with the island's physical dilemma. It's every bit as bad, troubling and vexing as that physical dilemma is.
Right.
So, Earl, what about you? What drew you to this island? You spent 14 months there. And how were you received by the local population?
Well, this is a population that has been a curiosity for journalists for more than a century, and so Tangiermen have become pretty savvy in dealing with reporters over the years, and I think that for probably the first month I was on the island, they assumed I was there to do what most other reporters do, which is show up, spend a couple of days on the island, and leave, and write essentially the same story that every other reporter who's ever been there has written, talking about how quaint and lost in time the place is, making note of the odd pattern of, you know, style of speech that islanders have, which is a product of their isolation. And it probably took a month, 6 weeks for them for them to slowly come to the realization that, well, no, wait, I wasn't going anywhere. I was sticking around. And to kind of change their, to recalibrate their dealings with me. And, you know, I was spending the same time just kind of showing my face around the island, going to church four times a week. You know, it's very close to a working theocracy of old Methodism. And so going to church is absolutely essential to understanding how the island ticks. But, you know, very few reporters spend the night on the island, let alone spend a Saturday night and all day Sunday there so that you can go to church. And they miss out an awful lot of what's necessary to understand the place. I mean, you know, you're on an island in the middle of Chesapeake Bay. Most everything about your day is beyond your control. You know, you're subject to the whims of Mother Nature to a degree that most of us on the mainland can't fathom. So no surprise that the Cane Shearmen have relied on faith for, you know, for their entire existence there, really, to get them through the day. And it's an extremely important element of island society.
We're speaking with Earl Swift. He's the author of the new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And in addition to going to church four times a week, I'm sure you were out on the water experiencing crabbing and oystering too.
I did both. Crabbing is much more agreeable weather-wise, I'll tell you that. to go oystering in mid-December when the wind's blowing at 35 miles per hour and you're in 4-foot seas and spray is coming up and, you know, freezing on everything it touches. That's an acquired taste that has you liking that. I never acquired it, but I found it fascinating in crabbing, perhaps even more so, because they're interesting animals. They're strange creatures.
Right. So let's now turn our attention to the challenges. You cited some of them, the cultural challenges that the younger demographic is moving off the island. Although at times they've had biological challenges, let's call them, with disease or so, or water pollution, that seems to be on hold right now or improving. But the biggest challenge the island faces is its physical disappearance, which is either occurred, depending on who you talk to, it seems, either a function of sea level rise or simply ongoing erosion of the island. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, if you were to speak to a scientist, and I mean just about every scientist on the planet, there would be no disagreement as to what's going on. What's happening is a product of sea level rise. It is erosion, but these are not mutually exclusive phenomena. They're interlinked. The bay has been on the rise for a long time. There's a point of inflection if you go back and you look at erosion on the Chesapeake and land loss on the Chesapeake. There's a point of inflection that occurs right around 1850, right at the midpoint of the 19th century. Something happened to accelerate the process. And beginning then and accelerating all through the rest of the 19th century, moving into a gallop during the 20th, and now moving at breakneck pace, this process of sea level rise and a resulting ferocity in the erosion that occurs on the bay has claimed land at an ever more alarming pace. And what you see on Tangier is an island that was three times the size it is now in 1850. Lost an average of 8 acres a year since then. Did not have a lot of acres to begin with.
Right.
But now it's down to an area, if you were to include all of the outlying islands and marshy islets, it would be a little smaller than New York Central Park. And all the buildable land on the island, the ridges, as they're called there, these sandy loam ribs on which houses are built, kind of constitute an island within the island, because they're the only high and dry land you can you can actually occupy. Those would all lumped together be significantly smaller than the reservoir at the middle of Central Park.
Okay.
Wow.
We're not talking about a big piece of land.
Right.
And you know, as the water comes up, as the island's relationship to the water shifts, not only because of that sea level rise, but because of the island's subsidence, which is a byproduct of the last ice age, you know, we're just going to see, if you were to chart what's happening, if you were to chart land loss at Tangier and elsewhere, this is not a straight diagonal line. It's a parabolic curve. It gets worse as you go.
Wow.
And so we're seeing now possibly the end times for the island, unless some truly heroic intervention is undertaken to try to halt it.
Now, the islanders have a different take on what is happening to their island, right, rather than climate change and sea level rise?
They see it as strictly erosion, and they point to the loss of islands in the 19th century as evidence of that view. They say, hey, well, look, there wasn't sea level rise and, you know, way back in the 1880s when Holland Island started to disappear. And the fact is, well, yeah, there was. We didn't call it that at the time. We didn't recognize it as such. But if you go back and you look at the evidence that was gathered at that point and you view it in the context of what we know today, heck yeah, there was sea level rise. Not nearly at the rate it's going on, it's occurring at now, but it was happening. And again, there is a point of inflection in the mid-19th century at which you really see this process kick into gear. And whether that's because that period coincides with the Industrial Revolution really getting underway in a profound way, or whether it's the end of the Little Ice Age that figures into it, which lasted a few hundred years and wrapped up at the beginning of the 19th century. Whatever you ascribe it to, the numbers suggest that's about the start for the processes that we're now seeing moving at a breakneck pace.
Right.
You point out that over the past four centuries, more than 500 islands have disappeared from the bay, and about 40 of them were once inhabited. So this is far from the first island to kind of face this set of problems.
Well, of course, not all of them were abandoned because of sea level rise.
Right.
You know, there were some that people just found too lonely and forbidding to live on. But
understandable.
But you bet. You know, if you look around the bay, Holland Island's a great example. It was home to, I think, 231 people in 1900. The erosion from the west, wind-driven waves, of course, helped along by the fact that the water was on the rise, tore away one of the ridges on which people had built their homes. Folks either abandoned the houses or they picked them up and barged them to the mainland or elsewhere. And with that huge piece of the population removed, Holland's economy imploded, and it prompted everybody else to leave. So that we went from 231 people in 1900 to zero by 1919.
Right.
And you see that sort of thing again and again all around the bay. Well, visible from Tangier, 4 miles away, is Watts Island, which once had 20-odd houses, a church, a store. And I visited Watts when I was on a kayak trip around the bay in 1994, and it took me about an hour to walk its perimeter. It took me a good long time. And I saw no signs of its past habitation. When I went back to Tangier to live in 2016, I was astounded to see that Watts had shrunk to about a third of its size in 1994.
Right.
And it's going fast. You can almost see it get smaller by the day.
So,
this process is, it's going to play out on the Chesapeake in a very short amount of time.
Okay, so now let's transition there to potential solutions. What would the islanders like to see happen to, in effect, save this island?
Well, they are facing, as with almost with each day that passes, Chris, the solution would have to be more heroic. I think they would love to see a wall built around the entire island, a riprap armoring of the island's edges, and then they'd like to see dredge spoils pumped into the island's interior to raise its level and buy them a century or more of continued existence. And, that's certainly technically feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Financially, however, it's a tough sell. Insofar as you've got 460 people living on the island, and that number is dropping. And that the price tag for such an operation would run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And there is a proposal on the table. It's a long shot, and I think the Corps of Engineers, which developed this concept, would admit to you that it's a long shot. But rather than save the island for people, which the Corps of Engineers might not be able to justify,
mm-hmm.
There's a chance that they could possibly try to save it for wildlife as habitat being worth more financially than the infrastructure of the town. And if that happened, if they were able to save the island that way, it's possible that they could save the town as a byproduct of saving the birds. Whether they're able to pull that off is a question mark. It's got to go through a lengthy and iffy process,
right,
to win approval and funding.
Well, they haven't had any success, say, with the Army Corps of Engineers under previous administrations. So they actually have much more faith, let's call it, in this current administration and this president, who they supported heavily, being very conservative town. And they believe that this president could, well, in effect, build them a wall.
Well, they certainly hope that's the case. They voted for him to the tune of 88%. I mean, of the 253 votes cast, 221 of them were for Donald Trump. And they did so, despite any concerns they might have had about his personal peccadilloes. They saw him as a guy who could cut through red tape that they felt had mired every promised attempt by the promised effort by the Army Corps of Engineers to come to their rescue. And they figured, hey, here's a guy who knows how to build, is successful in business, can ramrod a solution through so that we're not, waiting for a wall and treading water at the same time. They remain very much Trump supporters.
Mm.
And ever hopeful that he will personally intervene on their behalf.
Right.
Is there an element of faith in this as well? You talk about the deep faith of the population, the community that lives there, and how they see that their faith has gotten them through other hard times. Do you think that there's an element of that with this this idea of saving the island?
Well, I don't know if it's directly related to their support of Donald Trump, but yes, of course, they see themselves as an anointed people, because if you look back through Tangier history, there have been instances upon instances where, by all rights, the island should have been wiped out. I mean, there was a terrible hurricane in 1821. There were outbreaks of various pestilences throughout the 19th century that should have laid the place low. Of course, a host of hurricanes in the 20th century as well that have really leveled some some knockout punches on the place.
Mm-hmm.
And each time, the blow has been just shy of that necessary to keep them down. And so they've come to see themselves as anointed by their faith, armored by the power of prayer. They firmly believe that, and they see themselves basically in God's hands yet again here, and they are confident that they will be saved, that their prayer will see them through once more. And whether the agent of that salvation is our current president or the Army Corps of Engineers, or whomever, they are confident that it will occur.
Well, after spending 14 months there with these islanders, obviously developing relationships with them and kind of immersing yourself in their culture and daily lives, I know you need to remain objective, but do you feel like this is an island that's worth saving? Because that's a big question, Earl, because there are many coastal barrier islands around the country that are confronting the same issues on different scales and different rates. But is this an island that is worth saving?
Well, that's the whole ball of wax right there. I mean, the fact is that we have 88,000 miles of shoreline. A lot of it is going to be imperiled in the next few years.
Right.
And Tangier is just the first of perhaps thousands of coastal communities that are going to find themselves in this situation. It's the canary in the coal mine. So this is not an isolated case. It's an isolated case right now, but this is something that's coming to a neighborhood near you very soon.
Right.
Now, we know that we don't have the time, the money, or the technical means to save all of the places that will be in peril. So we have to develop, as a people, as a country, a rubric for deciding that very question you ask: what's worth saving? What do we value? What's important to us?
Mm-hmm.
It could be that we do it strictly on the basis of headcount, which would doom an awful lot of smaller places that we consider important, as Americans, that have been key to our history or that are key to our culture, or that we just liked, that we, for whatever reason. Places like Jamestown or Yorktown.
Right.
Any number of places like that. Any beach resort, you name it. It's part of that. It's going to be one of those smaller towns that will bite the dust if we decide we're only going to save places with a certain critical mass of human presence. So we have to develop this yardstick we have to come up with a way to quantify value, quantify importance.
Right.
And it's going to be an ugly process. Deciding what to save won't be as hard as deciding how to decide. And it's going to require much smarter people than me. So should Tangier be saved? I don't know. Do I love the place? Would I love to see it saved? Of course.
Yeah.
It's unique is a word that we throw around a lot, but this is truly a unique place in the American landscape. There is no other town like it. There's no other, it's developed its own language, for goodness sake. I think that it would make us a little less interesting as a country to not have it helping to define the outer limits, the breadth of what it means to be an American.
Right.
But again, that's going to be such a difficult decision.
Right, Earl, because I believe we've talked about this on other previous shows, that at some point, communities will also have to agree that there may be at least portions of their islands that will become uninhabitable, and that maybe communities or municipalities will say, you know what, you can't live here anymore. We have to rezone this area. And those are parts of the difficult decisions that people have to agree to uninhabit certain coastal barrier islands like this.
Which brings problems of its own.
Yes.
It's easier said than done.
Yeah.
You've got a population on Tangier that can't sell. their houses. Mm. Who wants to buy a house on a sinking island, a disappearing island? So you've got this captive population that can't sell their houses in order to get the down payment necessary to buy a house to relocate to the mainland. So that means, okay, if you're going to issue that edict, you can't live here anymore, then you're going to have to put your money where your mouth is because these folks don't have it.
Right. And I'm just trying to think of an analog here out west. Out west, it's almost the reverse, where there will be a point in time we have not enough water to support growing populations or a community's idea or aspirations to expand. And so that will come a day where the community or municipality will have to say, no, you can't build here anymore. We cannot support any increase. So it's on both sides confronting the same existential crisis.
Well, the wicked irony built into the dilemmas we face is if they're all coming home to roost at the same time. We're going to drain our aquifers right at about the time that the water, you know, the seas rise too high to live with, and we're going to have a lot on our plate.
Well, maybe your next book is about that situation going on out here out west, Earl. Come on out here for
Fire
14
ice.
Months. Yeah. Well, the name of the book is Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. The author is Earl Swift. And Earl, thanks again so much for taking the time to join us. Do you have a website or a blog you want to pitch?
Well, my website is earlswift.com.
All right.
And you can find all my books and other stuff there.
All right. Perfect.
Fantastic.
It's a great book. Interesting, fascinating read. And thank you again so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Really appreciate it.
Let's take a break for some underwriters. And we come back. We got some bunch of news items to cover, including we'll follow on a little segue into another challenge a species is facing. Doing the sea level.
That's right. The salt marshes are impacting not just our human communities, but wildlife too.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Travis Vernon, fly fishing coordinator of JANS and longtime supporter of KPCW. Our fly fishing department and guide service is open year-round and offers a full line of flies and product, including brands like Sims, Sage, and Fishpond. We also rent rods, reels, and waders. Available at the flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or JANS.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues. Concepts of sustainability, resilience.
That's right. Adaptation.
Adaptation. That's a good one. Concept. We need to add that. Concepts
we do.
Of sustainability.
We're going to have to change our tagline.
Yes, yeah, sustainability is not cutting it anymore.
That's
I think
right.
Resiliency and adaptation are probably becoming more critical in our, well, in a lot of communities, survival these days.
Right.
So speaking of communities, let's turn our attention to a biological-based community.
Yeah. So Earl Swift briefly mentioned, you know, this Army Corps proposal that would save Tangier Island, not for the people that lived there, but for the bird species.
Right.
And then the people could be kind of like this bonus. Well, hey, we can save the community too because
and
we're doing all this work to save the island.
Provide habitat for the estuary, for the crabs, the juvenile crabs, oysters, right. So a nursery.
Right. All of those important pieces, sort of those wetland pieces. And so I thought it would be kind of timely to highlight the salt marsh sparrows. And they're kind of the challenge that this species is facing. Right now, scientists are studying these in Hammonasset Beach and in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And the summary of the story here is that this species breeds in coastal marshes from Maine to Virginia. and lives only on the Atlantic coast. And they've always been kind of at the mercy of the tide and time and storms and things like that. But they've always been able to lay their eggs, you know, build their nests, lay their eggs, breed between the highest spring tides. But now, you know, with sea level rise, just that fraction of an inch, pushing the tides higher and higher is threatening the bird's survival. So their population has been declining about 9% a year since the late 1990s. They now number somewhere between 40,000 and 80,000. I know that's a big range.
Wow.
But the population estimates are really difficult because the birds are so tough to find. Their nests are the size of half of a baseball.
Man, but there's 40,000 of them.
Half of a baseball, Chris. They're tiny. And they're hidden
little.
In the salt marshes, amongst the grasses. And so these birds do have some adaptations to living in these environments because, again, they've been there forever. So the young, before they can even fly, they can climb the grass. They have learned how to climb the grass. And this one is nuts to me. The eggs can be submerged for up to 90 minutes and the little, you know, chicks can still survive.
Huh.
So they can survive without like the oxygen that usually circles through that membrane, and they can survive the temperature drop as well, which again for most species is a non-starter.
I would think that the eggs would just float.
Float.
But I guess eggs maybe.
You don't want them to leave the nest, I guess.
Okay. All right. So that's a measure of adaptation to, you know, conditions.
Thousands of years, hundreds of years.
But you're saying that just small changes in water level rise, sea level rise, is creating this
Right. So
impact.
The highest tides are higher, you know, and they're getting these high tides that are inundating the marshes are getting closer and closer together, just as we were talking about on Tangier Island. So it's not enough time for, you know, in many cases, it's not enough time to have that brood lay those eggs and raise the chicks to the point where they can fly away out of the inundated salt marsh. And so and the other thing that the scientists that are studying these are now starting to understand is that, you know, the decrease is somewhat gradual right now. I mean, it's been somewhat linear, but then there will just kind of be this threshold where there is not enough time between the tides for any birds, even if it's perfectly timed, to lay their eggs and raise their young. And so then there would just be an almost immediate extinction, right, within about 6 years as the mature birds aren't able to nest successfully and die off. So they say that turning point may arrive sometime between 2030 on the inside, which is really soon,
right?
And then 2060, depending on sea level rise and, you know,
rate
climate.
Of rise. Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a fascinating example, and it's not the only species that's facing this.
That's right. I was just going to say that. Again, what's the name of this bird?
This is the salt marsh sparrow.
Salt marsh sparrow.
Yeah.
And if there's a salt marsh sparrow, there may be other like species that are facing similar challenges, and they may not just be birds.
Right.
All estuaries are homes to birds, of course, sea life, marine life.
Yep.
Land-based animals that take advantage of estuary
that
for
use
hunting.
Those for hunting and food.
So everything is affected. This is just an example, a specific example of how small changes, and we've always talked about this now, just small changes
right.
in
we're talking
environmental
about
conditions.
Tiny fractions of an inch in sea level rise, and it's enough to make the highest tides too high.
Too high. But then there's also potential chemical effects because the salinity might change, and then that results
the
in
the availability
biological
of
effect.
Oxygen,
right.
The soil.
So all of these things are in play, and this is the consequence that these 40 to 60, 70,000 sparrows are at risk. But it's a wonderful example of how the biology, our ecosystems, are changing. Because of, at the end of the day, a warmer planet.
Exactly.
It's a warmer planet.
It's a warmer planet. So, okay.
Never mind. What maybe there's weather effects that affect the sparrows' conditions too, health and welfare. Warmer days, warmer nights.
Warmer nights.
We always talk about that.
So just kind of looking to the future for this species, you know, these researchers are saying the end, though it could be really close for this species, is not absolutely certain because, you know, animals can move. Birds have moved in the past. Granted, yeah, it was over a much longer timeline. And they had available land to move to. So if a salt marsh got wiped out by a storm or a salt marsh was inundated, they could move to another salt marsh. In this case, you know, as they look inland, those areas are built upon.
Right.
But they're starting to strategize about these researchers and some policymakers are starting to strategize about like where they might go. So they're starting to look at things even like old drainage ditches and irrigation ditches, places that are low-lying that have some of those same qualities that still exist inland. So, you know, can we preserve enough land inland of these salt marshes and protect them? And
right.
Can we help?
So, you know what they need now? They need a wall.
A lot of walls need to be built.
Well, at least they're, you know, yeah, what? At least they're somewhat more accommodating than humans in that fact that maybe they'll get up and leave. when, you know, push comes to shove.
Exactly. When their habitat's gone.
Yeah.
They'll see the writing on the
message.
Wall.
They get the message. All right. Fascinating story. Like you say, an analog, again, an analogous situation between what's going on in Tangier Islands with us humans and what's going on in salt marshes with birds.
We're maybe that Army Corps of Engineers plan is not all that far-fetched. You know, we'll see.
Okay. Well, here's some good news. Another story. Colorado Parks and Wildlife just announced they've discovered a species of cutthroat trout previously thought to be extinct. The fish in question is related to a museum specimen collected back in 1874 and housed in the Smithsonian. Now biologists know this unique species of Colorado River cutthroat is alive and well in 8 small populations around the San Juan River Basin in southwest Colorado. John Alves, senior aquatic biologist for Parks and Wildlife in the region, said the discovery was only made possible because of recent advances in genetic testing. And he also says, along comes drought this year and the fire, and we had to rescue fish. Sounds familiar? We had to rescue fish
here in Utah.
From 2 populations in the 416 fire area north of Durango, and that's where they were discovered. He said their goal is to raise these new, these previously thought extinct types of cutthroat trout in hatcheries.
Whew. It's a scary job. High stakes.
Yeah, and then, you know, hopefully expand their population.
Wait, so they discovered these because they were taking the fish out for a fire?
Yes.
That is so interesting.
Just like what was going on down near St. George.
That's right.
The story we told about how they were recovering fairly rare species of cutthroats from that one stream. Well, they did the same thing in southwest Colorado. And lo and behold, hey, what's this cutthroat trout? This is one we thought you were extinct. Well, no, I've been here the whole time.
It's
right
always amazing to hear those stories.
Yeah.
Hiding in plain sight, you know?
Hiding
streams that people fish and hike around.
And once again, what we don't know, we still don't know about our ecosystems and habitats. Even on land, we talked about oceans,
right,
what little we know about our oceans. Here we don't even know about what's literally in our backyard. Cutthroat trout. All right, good story. Let's take another break. We got a few more minutes. Let's turn. We've got a news story or two item about renewable energy.
Energy.
All right. We'll be right back. It's This Green Earth.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we have a couple minutes to share a few more news highlights with you. And, you know, we're always talking about the impacts of the energy that we use and climate change.
Yeah.
So we have some good news about
what's
shift
going on
in energy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. First, the Oyster Creek, speaking of, you know, this is a whole marine-based show. Even the nuclear power plant is named the Oyster
Entirely
Creek.
Entirely planned that way.
The Oyster Creek Nuclear Generating Station, located near me, where I grew up, in around Philadelphia, 50 miles east of Philadelphia, in New Jersey, is scheduled to retire. Well, yesterday. The plant first came online in December 1st, 1969, making it the oldest commercially operated nuclear power plant in the U.S. Now, Oyster Creek was previously expected to retire at the end of 2019, so it was supposed to continue on another year. But that retirement was accelerated by Exelon, their owner, by more than a year to coincide with the plant's fuel and maintenance cycle, they say, which means basically it was too expensive to do their annual maintenance and other upgrades, et cetera. So they decided to retire this plant 1 year early, which is pretty interesting. It'll undergo what's called decommissioning. This is another interesting part. The typical decommissioning period for a nuclear power plant is, guess?
I am reading it here in front of me, so it says, you know, we'll give our listeners a minute to guess.
Anybody?
1 year, 10 years?
20? 40? No, 60 years. It'll take 60 years for the plant to fully decommission, meaning pulling out all the rods, managing the waste, and doing so in a way that doesn't potentially harm the environment or local population. So it'll be around for another 60 till basically the end of this century. Now, Oyster Creek will be the sixth nuclear power plant to retire in the past 5 years. After Oyster Creek's retirement, the U.S. will have 98 operating nuclear reactors at 59 different plants. 12 of these reactors are scheduled to retire within the next 7 years. So within the next 7 years, we'll go from 98 down to 86, and that's another 15% that are scheduled for retirement. So very interesting with respect to nuclear power, nuclear generation in this country.
The investment and the time spent on that decommissioning is just shocking. It's enormous. I mean, generations later, you're still working on decommissioning.
And so plants that retired 10, 20, 30 years ago, if there were any, that are still under decommissioning processes. That's nuclear power.
That's what you
get with nuclear power. All right, we got three more minutes. Here's some interesting news about renewable electricity generation over the last 10 years. Now, hydroelectricity represented the largest share of electricity generation among renewable resources in 28 states back in 2007. But since then, that's gone from 28 states down to 19 states. Meanwhile, the number of states who rely on renewable electricity generation, this is getting confusing,
primarily by wind,
thank you, has gone from 7 states in 2007 to 16 states in 2017.
And we should mention that solar became the most prevalent renewable generation source in seven states in the country, and we're one of those states.
Yeah, and it used to be it was zero.
Zero
in 2000,
states.
And so now 7 states find most of their renewable energy from solar, including Utah. How about
that's
that?
That's exciting.
Now, coal still generates the majority of our electricity in the state, but solar is making a run, and wind.
Mm-hmm.
So encouraging news there on the renewable energy front.
Yeah.
All right. And we got another minute. Do you have a calendar event or anything you want to share?
Well,
you got 1 minute.
I mean, yeah, if I'm going to have a minute. So at the Swanner Eco Center, I want to mention our new exhibit. So
does that have to do with spiders?
It does. Arachnids, more specifically.
Yeah.
It's called The Art and Science of Arachnids. You'll learn some good popular culture facts about arachnids. There are also 100 live specimens of arachnids in the exhibit from all over the world.
They're not out loose.
They're not loose. They're actually they're in these terrariums with the tops screwed on, and then inside an isolated room.
All right,
you are 100% safe.
Do they include poisonous species?
Yeah.
Oh, which one? Do you have
many
spider?
Of them, because many of them are these huge tarantulas. They're so cool.
Oh, well, those are nice.
Yeah, so I would encourage people to
you don't
come
have a brown recluse
check it
in
out.
You, do you?
We do
please
not have a brown.
Say it. Thank you.
We really are focused on the larger spiders because the smaller ones don't show as well, and they don't live as long, and they,
and they're hiding.
Yeah, exactly.
Can't. Okay.
It's a museum exhibit. The point is to see something, so...
You can just say there's a brown recluse somewhere in here. Done. So, okay, real quick, what is the schedule? How do I see these?
Okay, so the exhibit is in through December 9th, and it's open during our public hours, Wednesday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. It is a ticketed exhibit, so it's $4 for kids and $7 for adults, or if you're a member, it's free. So, you've got a good option there. And we'll also be announcing a couple of locals' free days as we get those pinned down. So,
All right.
Come by and check it out.
Okay. And that goes till when?
December 9th.
Oh, my goodness.
They're there
for a while.
Yeah.
They're there for the whole
12 weeks.
Their whole fall is taken up. Their schedule.
Yes, showing just, it.
This tarantula schedule is bucked.
Yeah.
All right.
Is my clock off? We're done.
50 seconds.
Okay.
So that's perfect segue to thank, thank our guest again, Earl Swift, the author of Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Also, let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course, listeners like you. You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.